This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Shani Jardin, sitting in for Brooke Gladstone. Article 2 of the U.S. Constitution is basically a bare-bones job description for the nation's president. The first section lays out the prerequisites, and the last details the procedures for early termination. In between, there's just two other sections. One expounds on the basic powers of the office, and the other requires that the president, from time to time, give to Congress information of the State of the Union. That's it. From time to time, not every year. Give information, not proffer a laundry list of policy initiatives and market-tested political rhetoric. But over the years, the basic mandate has spawned an elaborate annual rite. On the eve of this past Tuesday's latest installment, Slate political correspondent John Dickerson offered a brief history of that spectacle. Turns out, it was not always thus.
Presidents have not always had to do it in person. In fact, Thomas Jefferson, in 1801, stopped the ceremony. He said it smacked too much of the British monarchy, and so he delivered his address by mail. And that was continued for about 100 years when Woodrow Wilson revived the ceremony and started doing it in person again. And it was done in the afternoon. It was not the major national event that it is now. Of course, there weren't televisions at that point, but it took Lyndon Johnson to move it into prime time to turn the State of the Union into the massive media national spectacle that it is now.
So as the State of the Union moved into becoming, well, a media event, how did that affect the content and the role of the State of the Union culturally?
Well, it started to become a more political speech. When Johnson in 1966 put it into prime time, that was the first time the opposition party, in that case the Republicans, insisted on having a response to the president. And that really locked it in as a purely political speech. If Thomas Jefferson were alive today, he would weep watching the president walk into the House chamber because members of Congress, they paw at him. They shake his hand. They smile. They kiss him in some instances. And it's as if they're trying to, you know, touch the hem of the royal garment. And the members of Congress are doing this, of course, because they want to be seen in prime time back in the home district with the president.
So, John, this evolution into theatrics also includes other players other than the president taking part in this.
That's right. Well, Ronald Reagan, the former actor, knew how to spruce up an event. So one year, he began the tradition of pointing to members in the balcony.
In the midst of a terrible tragedy on the Potomac, we saw again the spirit of American heroism at its finest. And we saw the heroism of one of our young government employees, Lenny Skutnik, who, when he saw a woman lose her grip on the helicopter line, dived into the water and dragged her to safety.
And so he pointed to Lenny Skutnik. And now we are stuck with that tradition of pointing to members in the gallery, which the president did on Tuesday evening, pointing out a family of a slain U.S. serviceman.
So you also talked about the applause race during the address. What's wrong with a little bit of applause?
Well, nothing's wrong with a little bit of applause. It's just that when it becomes really a line of applause interrupted by a speech, then that kind of gets the order wrong. And this is, in fact, our fault. The press used to treat, and still does in some ways, the number of applause interruptions as if it's a gauge of something serious. John Kennedy's first State of the Union address in 1961, the New York Times mentioned the fact that Kennedy had gotten, I think it was 30-some-odd interruptions in his speech, and that that was different from the average that Eisenhower had gotten. They were measuring quite seriously the number of interruptions and using them as a gauge to inform readers about how much the Congress approved of the president's program.
In your Slate piece, it's almost like you're tracing an arc of the State of the Union from its beginnings as a primarily text-based document to something that was delivered orally to something that became a media event. And I'm wondering what you see the next phase in that evolution. I mean, is this something that the president could conceivably just email, you know, BCCing the rest of the nation?
That would be a great idea. It would spare us some of this. I say that, though, but Americans like their rituals, and it's important to have ceremonies every once in a while as long as we all don't take them too seriously. But I think it would be great if the president would put out a text of his speech and have the proposals that he offers be, say, hyperlinked to items in his budget. Presidents always put out their budget a few days after the State of the Union, and it often contradicts what's been said in the State of the Union. And it would be great to be able to sort of see those side by side. I think also it would be clever. No White House would want to do this, but certainly it would be clever for some journalists to take the previous year's speech and hyperlink the promises there to the actual realities as they came to pass. So there are lots of ways that you can sort of annotate the speeches to keep the president honest, because one of the problems with it becoming a show and becoming a political act is that it encourages lots of applause lines that tend to be divorced from the reality of the world. And it also encourages the kind of political rhetoric that's maybe fine for a convention, but there's, you know, it's a good thing we only have them every 4 years. It's usually the kind of thing that gets everybody cheering, but that doesn't usually lead to a lot of good solutions.
Well, maybe if they just sent it out as a text message to phones, that'd solve the wordiness problem, because then you'd be limited to, 162 characters.
That's right. It would force them into incredibly succinct thinking. That's right.
Well, John Dickerson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
John Dickerson is chief political correspondent for Slate.